The SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content.
Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my SparkFile. To be something that I want to make or how I want to be, I pump it in my SparkFile. I jump into my SparkFile.
Welcome to the Spark File, your one-stop festival for creative inspiration.
I'm Laura Camion.
And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're an OG listener, welcome back, Sparkler. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome. You may be asking yourself, what exactly is a Spark File? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are such good questions, and we have got answers.
A Spark File is a place where you consistently collect all of your inspirations and fascinations.
Here's the deal. We're makers. We make all kinds of things.
And if you're anything like us, and you're making stuff all the time, or want to be making stuff all the time, you know the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry.
So we're on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up off of our asses and make things like this podcast.
Or a consistent practice that you, and possibly only you, believe in.
I don't know what it is, but I love that. Or a festival celebrating the great voices of our past, present, and future.
Every episode, we're going to reach into the Spark File and exchange some sparks. And from time to time, we're going to talk to some folks who spark us too.
And if you're not careful, you might believe the children are our future. Ooh. So without further ado, let's open up
the Spark File. What the heck?
Oh, Camion.
These are crazy times.
Crazy times call for crazy measures.
Crazy intros.
These are times, Camion.
Suze, I'm just gonna, can I just go right to the heart of it?
Clear the air,
Cams.
Because
it's just on my mind.
Say it.
You know that I have been saying for quite a few weeks now that I wanted to do like a follow-up episode, a follow-up spark to my spark flu of 1918.
The big grape flu, yeah.
The Spanish flu.
The big grape flu is what they called it.
The grape flu. The big grape flu. And I was going to do it like as all of this stuff started happening.
With the coronavirus.
With the coronavirus. Yeah. I was going to do this follow-up. But lo and behold, things have been happening so fast and furious on that front. Like there's really no way to capture it. Like right now, we are in the midst of late breaking news, you know, every moment to moment. Yeah. So I couldn't do that, and maybe I will at some point find a way to do that, but we're just in the thick of it right now. So there is one thing that I came across, though, that I found fascinating and certainly related. So I thought that I would just, you know, acknowledge where we are in this moment and dive into this little spark.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you diving straight in?
I'm diving right in. So, if you're listening to the news at all, you know that by now the very best way that you can avoid catching the COVID-19 virus or germs or any flu or other virus for that matter is to wash your hands.
Wash your hands, don't touch your face.
Wash your hands.
We started at our house instead of like when you get off the phone and instead of saying to Nathan, I love you, I love you. We say, I love you. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face.
See, that's it. It's so simple.
And I realize how much I touch my face.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't stop touching my face, but I have to stop touching my face.
If you touch your face, go wash your hands and let the cycle begin again. But wash your hands. Wash them before you eat, after you use the bathroom, as soon as you enter the house. If you've touched your phone or the TV remote control, just wash your hands. Mm. It's not panic. Like this is not controversial. It's just simple. Just wash your hands. Mm-hmm. But as with all things that we seem to take for granted now, there was a time when washing one's hands was not only not considered common sense, promoting the washing of hands was outright scandalous, and fighting for it cost one esteemed doctor his entire career.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. So it seems like so simple. Like, how could you argue with washing your hands? Many people did. So this information can be found in many places, but I got most of my spark from an article in National Geographic by Nina Strachlik, NPR, globalhandwashing.com, and Wikipedia.
Went straight to the source on that one.
All right. So let me tell you a little story about a man named Ignaz Semmelweis.
That name is everything.
I knew it. Please continue. I knew. I was like, as soon as I wrote that down, I was like, Susan's going to love this guy's name.
I do love a good name.
Ignaz Semmelweis. One S. He was a Hungarian physician. So it's the 1840s.
Okay.
And Semmelweis was becoming more and more curious in this moment about why so many women were dying from what they called childbed fever. Like, even in the most prominent hospitals and with the best medical care of that time, women, way too many women, were giving birth and then contracting a fever shortly after.
Wow.
And then dying.
Yeah.
And he wanted to figure out, you know, why, what the hell was happening. Now, keep in mind, during these years, there's still a battle going on between doctors who believed that, like, bad air and evil spirits cause disease.
Yeah.
And those people who believe that doctors should have fact-based, evidence-based knowledge, mm-hmm. you know, science. Side spark, the people who fought for evidence-based knowledge are a spark in and of themselves,
yes.
because it was a battle bigger than we have any idea of.
And we may be revisiting it right now.
And maybe the battle is still ongoing,
the
right?
The battle rages on.
Right? So at the time, Semmelweis worked
this
at...
This is 1840s. Is this Downton Abbey times? You know how we talk about putting it in the historical context? Is this Lady Sybil?
It's
spoiler alert.
A little bit before that, but
okay.
But it could still be going on. And as I tell you the story, you'll see why. Like, it continued.
That's what I'm
going
to picture. I'm picturing Lady Sybil.
Absolutely.
I'm picturing Downton Abbey times childbirth.
Yeah.
And where's he located?
That works.
He's in.
Well, he is from Hungary.
Okay.
But he is working at this time in Vienna.
Vienna.
In Austria.
I'm picturing it all.
Yes, picture it all.
Vienna.
This is all good
stuff.
I picture
the sausages.
Okay.
I picture, yes.
Interesting. Okay. Sausages.
Yep.
Yeah.
Vienna.
Okay. So here he is working at Vienna General Hospital.
Travel with us.
Travel with us. With so many details. A detailed picture of sausages.
I have to, it's so funny we talk about this. This is the only way I can learn stuff.
No,
it's to
essential.
Contextualize it.
It's essential.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, though.
No.
Rock
that's all
on,
right.
Ignaz
okay.
Semmelweis.
All right.
Here we go.
So, Semmelweis worked at Vienna General Hospital in Austria, and this hospital had two different maternity wards. In one of the wards, the babies were delivered by male doctors, and in the other ward, babies were delivered by female midwives.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
Oh,
and
could you choose?
I don't know why.
Okay. Just
I somehow feel like choice wasn't so much a
like,
part
like
of things at
financial,
that time.
Maybe social class, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
Or it could go back to that science versus spiritual question. So if you were someone who wanted a medical doctor mm-hmm. versus a midwife. But at that time, midwives would have been the people that for centuries had been helping women give
mm-hmm.
birth.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
We're speculating. We're really off-road speculation
okay.
here. But
look at us go.
Here we go. So he started looking into this childbed fever. He discovered that many more women were dying who had given birth in the ward that was served by the male doctors.
Mm.
Women under the care of the male doctors were dying at a rate more than twice as often
mm.
as the women who were being taken care of by female midwives.
Eek.
Eek, right? So obviously something's going on.
Yeah.
So he began to investigate a number of different factors that could have contributed to this statistic. He compared things like, was it A, the literal embarrassment of being examined by male doctors that could have caused the fever?
Wow.
B, was it the fact that priests were presiding over them, and did they, upon, you know, kind of waking up, see a priest and get scared to death? Like, did it scare the fever into
okay.
them?
Okay. Okay.
C, getting a little more scientific, was it to do with the woman's body position during birth? Because women, I believe, that were birthed by midwives were lying on their side
oh.
versus lying on their back. So he thought maybe because the approach was different and the woman's position during labor was different, maybe that caused a change. But he looked into all those factors and not surprisingly ruled them out.
Can I just say, I don't think in the depiction of childbirth, I've never given birth to a child, but I've never in all the things I've seen depicting childbirth, have I seen a woman on her side?
Me neither.
But okay.
But I suspect that until very, very recent times, like the world didn't see pictures of that at all. Like, imagine like even in our lifetime.
Yeah.
That was sort of taboo. And you certainly didn't show a woman, you know, a baby coming out of the birth canal.
Right.
But times, they have changed. So here we are. He ruled out all of those, you know, all of those possible reasons and looked into more. But eventually, he discovered a very big point of distinction that had to do with the schedule and the responsibilities of the male doctors. Turns out, in the mornings, the male doctors assisted their students with autopsies as part of their medical training. When they finished dissecting the cadavers, they'd head over to the maternity ward and deliver babies.
Ugh.
The midwives, on the other hand, had no contact with the dead bodies in the hospital. They stayed in their ward all day. So a true break in the case came when a pathologist in the hospital got ill and died. Apparently, this wasn't a very uncommon thing, but in this case, the man had pricked his finger while doing an autopsy on someone who had died of childbed fever. Then he got sick and he died. And Semmelweis looked into the pathologist's symptoms and saw that he had died from childbed fever. And this was crazy. This was like a revelation.
It was a man who had not given birth.
That's right.
To a child.
This meant that childbed fever was not just something that women died of. It was something that other people in the hospital could get sick from as well.
Wow.
And in this case, it had transferred from the body, the dead body, to the doctor doing the autopsy, and he in turn could give it to someone else.
Wow.
So this was a revelation.
Yeah.
At this time, remember that germ theory was still years away from becoming understood. So the concept of germs didn't exist. They weren't called germs. But Semmelweis knew something was being transferred. He conjectured that cadaverous particles might be responsible. It's essentially the same idea that like something so small that you can't see would be transferred from the cadaver, from the dead bodies to the new mothers by the doctors and students. Unlike today, they did not require scrubbing their hands between patients or autopsies in this case.
Wow.
So they could take their pathogens or, quote, decomposing animal organic matter, as Semmelweis called it, from place to place and person to person.
Wow.
A few decades later, Louis Pasteur and Joseph Lister would introduce us to germs. We'll talk about that in a minute. So regardless of what you call it, Semmelweis believed that he had discovered the issue. So in 1847, he implemented mandatory hand washing among the hospital staff who worked for him at the Vienna General Hospital. And instead of soap, he used a chlorinated lime solution because it was able to fully remove the smell of decay that lingered on the bodies and the doctor's hands after handling the dead
fully
bodies.
Fully chlorinated lime solution seems like it would just like rip your skin off your hands.
It seems like it might. Yeah.
It seems intense.
But it sanitized. So after the team began sanitizing themselves.
What he was aiming for is it got the smell off.
That's right. Because how else could you tell? If you couldn't see it, you didn't know. But he assumed if you could still smell it, it was probably still there.
Uh-huh.
So after the team started to sanitize themselves and their instruments, the mortality rate in the male doctor side of the maternity ward decreased drastically.
Wow.
Hooray.
Hooray.
Success. Yay for Semmelweis. He was very excited about this, and he set out to share this eureka moment with other doctors, assuming that they would care.
Yeah.
So, you know, they could develop best practices together.
Yeah.
So in 1850, he spoke at the Vienna Medical Society about hand washing. He gave an entire keynote about the benefits of washing your hands to a crowd of doctors. And suffice to say, it did not go well.
Wow.
It did not go well. The entire medical community rejected it. No joke, flat out rejected it. They questioned his science and his logic. And in subsequent years, historians have speculated that the theory was obviously going to be rejected because it put the blame on the doctors for their patient's death. And of course, the doctors were not interested in taking on that type of liability and responsibility.
Oh my God.
So it was ridiculed so thoroughly that despite the fact that they had reduced the mortality rates in the maternity ward, Semmelweis's own hospital abandoned the hand washing practice.
Oh no, it had yielded such good results.
That's right. So and away it went. Honestly, like to be forgotten for 100 years, but we'll get to that. The rejection of his observations is often traced back to what they call belief perseverance in psychology. Belief perseverance is the tendency to cling to discredited beliefs, even when presented with new evidence or information. There's some fields of study, like science and medicine, where belief perseverance is the single biggest block to scientific advances.
Wow.
And that really struck me because of the world we're living in now.
Yes.
I do see a little bit of...
I am also struck by that. Yeah,
belief perseverance hanging on around here.
Wow.
So something to think about. So Semmelweis had kind of some rough years after that, I would say. He left that job. He went back to Hungary, and again, he worked in a maternity ward. And despite what people thought of him, he introduced his hand washing practice at his new hospital. And again, mortality rates went down. Nonetheless, nobody gave him credit for it. No one connected it with the hand washing. Like, stop trying to make fetch happen, right? Everyone was like, it's not the hand washing. Yeah. So get over it. Yeah. Please stop talking about it. In 1858 and 1860, he published articles and then a book, including stats and information, along with his theories about hand washing, but still no go. His ideas were still not embraced. In fact, many other doctors took the time to like condemn his work.
Jesus.
They touted their own theories for the ongoing childbed fever epidemic. Around this same time, interestingly enough, a nurse named Florence Nightingale.
Yes.
Also another spark, side spark.
She is I dug into her just a little bit with in relation to rejected princesses.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, she was interesting.
Yeah, she's a whole, spark and deserves so much time. But she arrived on the scene during the Crimean War, which was between the British and the Russians. Yeah. And she was also extolling the virtues of hand washing. Mm. She implemented hand washing and other hygienic procedures in the war hospital that she worked in during that time. But again, it didn't take off any further.
God.
That was it.
It's, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm like so aghast, but at the same time, it takes time for evidence-based knowledge to catch up. Like it does, it takes time.
Well, also when we're talking about things that you cannot see.
Yes.
So it's very difficult
but
for people to...
time is so precious if your loved one is the one with childbed fever.
During these times, certainly hundreds of thousands of women's lives could have been saved.
Yes.
Honestly, if people had listened. To our dear friend Semmelweis. A few years later, his own health began to wane. Mm. Some people say he may have had Alzheimer's or dementia. Either way, he took a real turn for the worse. He began writing open letters to call out like other doctors by name. And these letters were just full of vitriol and anger and bitterness. He began talking about like childbirth fever in literally every conversation that he got into.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like his mind was fixated on that. He started taking up with possibly living with a prostitute, much to his wife's dismay.
Wow.
And eventually he was put into a mental institution and he died not long after. Died, sadly, not knowing, you know, what the contributions that he made. 2 years after his death, It's 1867. A Scottish surgeon named Joseph Lister also began promoting the idea of washing your hands and sanitizing your surgical instruments. Uh-huh. Sanitizing your surgical instruments.
There's a tongue twister. Woo! For you.
To stop infectious diseases. He faced many critics as well. Nonetheless, the idea started to take off a little in the 1870s as more doctors began to wash their hands regularly. Again, not out of a mandatory thing, but just, you know, several doctors were like, okay, I mean, worst case scenario, we're wrong about this. But
worst case scenario, our hands get a little chappy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Lister went on to become the father of antiseptic surgery.
Mm.
He was all about sterilization. Listerine antiseptic,
yes,
which was developed as a surgical antiseptic, but eventually became a mouthwash, was named after him in 1879. He went on to be a highly decorated surgeon with hospitals named after him, a funeral in Westminster Abbey.
There's your legacy.
And the establishment of the Lister Medal, which was created to honor top surgeons after his death. And his work began where Semmelweis's work left off. Mm. Eventually, other people also started to recognize that they may have been wrong about Semmelweis's work. A doctor named Louis Pasteur.
We know him.
We know him. He ended up developing the germ theory that we now understand and became, you know, well known and accepted, and changed how patients were cared for and how the cause and spread of diseases were investigated. He, of course, is the father of microbiology, invented the technique that would stop bacterial contamination, the process we called pasteurization.
These are huge contributions to society.
Huge.
It's insane.
Huge. He eventually created the first vaccines for rabies and anthrax. And of course, he also used a lot of Semmelweis's data.
Man, he got
as
a lot done.
The jumping off place for his work.
Wow. And
he's his own spark, for sure.
Yeah.
But neither of these guys would have been able to do what they did.
Yes.
Were it not for our friend Semmelweis.
They stood on his shoulders.
They did.
Yeah.
They did. If you can believe this, surgeons generally began scrubbing up in the 1870s, but hand washing for all,
yeah,
did not become universal until 100 years later.
What?
In the 1980s. That is in our lifetime, Susie B. Hand hygiene was officially incorporated into America's healthcare with national guidelines for all. 1980s.
Wait a second. That late?
That late.
You're kidding me.
I am not kidding.
Now, this makes me want to talk to Nancy Blackwell, retired registered nurse. I remember all through my childhood that her hands were always so dry and so chapped because she washed them all day long at work. And
yes,
that would have been in the, wait for it, the late 70s into the 80s and 90s.
Well, hospitals and surgeons took it on in the 1870s.
I know, but what are you saying? That
the general public becoming being encouraged to wash your hands.
Really?
That's 1980s. It became part of the handbook, the general guideline for good health in America, at least. Other countries may be different. Now, it sounds like, though, in the medical profession, they did embrace it. If your mom was washing her hands.
But I'm also thinking, I'm thinking back, I'm casting myself back through time to my elementary school bathroom. And I think we were always, it was like you go to the bathroom, you wash your hands, you...
That's right around the time. I think it was...
you're sweet. I mean...
You're saying it's 70s,
I'm
not
saying
80s.
It's 70s, yeah.
What I'm saying is on multiple websites that show the history of when the health
is it sort of when... Remember when we started to see literally posters in bathrooms with pictographs of here's how to wash your hands well.
That's right.
It's that.
So push. Our parents did not grow up with that, with those little signs saying wash your hands.
Yes, of course. Of course.
That's all within our lifetime.
Yeah.
Not all of our listeners' lifetimes, but our lifetimes. Yeah.
That's fucking batshit crazy.
It's fucking crazy how long it took from Semmelweis, Florence Nightingale, Lister, Pasteur. Like, come on, everybody. Wash your freaking hands.
Wash your goddamn hands.
So more than 100 years after the medical industry mocked him and his theories, the Medical University of Budapest changed its name to Semmelweis University in order to honor the man who continued to insist on hand washing.
Yes.
I mean, that healthcare really hinges on his like adamant. I mean, you could say it drove him literally crazy.
It is the thing that will make the difference for us, like saving our lives.
And now the so-called Semmelweis reflex became a term. It's a metaphor for a certain type of human behavior characterized by the reflex-like rejection of new knowledge because it contradicts entrenched norms, beliefs, or paradigms.
Wow.
It's named after Semmelweis, whose ideas were ridiculed and rejected by his contemporaries.
So let me see if I'm hearing you correctly. Mm-hmm. The Semmelweis reflex is when you have an existing belief, someone presents you with evidence that contradicts that belief, and you're like, no, that's not how
that
I know it,
or
that's not how it's been done.
I'm telling you, the earth is not flat. It is flat.
I feel like he would dig having that hospital or named after him. I wonder how he'd feel about having
the reflex,
like a lifetime of rejection, sort of summed up in a phrase like that.
Well, I feel like it illustrates again and again it illustrates the resistance to new information.
Fascinating.
And I kind of love that they named it after him, because that is all he experienced in his lifetime. God. Was a resistance to new knowledge. He had the facts, he had information, data, stats, whatever you want to call it. He had it all. And still, people couldn't. But I mean, we're really, really irresponsible with it too. And people, like, I've been in meetings where like data has been presented, not about either of these topics, but just data has been presented. Yeah. And the response is, oh, those numbers don't feel right. Like, well, they're not, it's not so much about how you feel about hand washing or how you feel about whether or not germs exist. It's scientific. And we know that they do. So, you know, it's a little crazy to be living in a time where we are, it seems like we're like going backwards a little bit.
It's so fascinating and enraging, frankly.
Enraging. So what do we make of it?
Well,
I got a list. I mean, I don't know. There's a lot. First of all, wash your hands. We make a practice of going to the bathroom, washing your hands.
Don't touch your face. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face.
But if you're Steven Soderbergh, you might make a show called The Nick, which is about a fictional hospital around the turn of the century.
Yes.
It was on Cinemax for 2 seasons. And I think there's way more room for more stories like this and explorations of, you know, how our medical practices came to be.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And the time specifically, like, his was a little bit after, but it was still, people were still struggling with it. But the time when medicine was still part of spiritual beliefs and part of science, and how exactly science won out, or whether or not we're still in the discussion about whether or not science won out. But I think there's way more stories, like people have an appetite for learning more about that. I think, again, because they mirror this time that we're in now.
Uh-huh.
I think I'd like to create a moment of gratitude for the people who fucking stuck to their guns trying to convince the world of scientific evidence. In some cases, they literally went crazy trying to convince people.
Yes.
I'd like to make a practice of checking my Semmelweis reflex for any biases that I might be unwilling to re-examine.
So good.
You know, just checking. Are you stubbornly clinging to old ideas that no longer have any evidence to support them? I mean, that comes up for me and my therapist all the time. She's always like, she's never called it that, but she will be like, this particular belief, how long has it been since you've had any evidence of that? And I'm like, oh, good point. Ooh, she's a goodie.
She sounds really good.
You can make a game of washing your hands for the millionth time. Did you see that poster that was going around on social media? Supposedly it was from the WeWork offices, but they made a little poster that is a list and lyrics of 6 songs that you can sing instead of Happy Birthday to occupy that 20 seconds while washing your hands. And it includes Lizzo's Good as Hell, but you sing it twice.
Okay.
Toto's Africa, Fleetwood Mac's Landslide, The Killers' Mr. Brightside, Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall, and finally, Beyonce's Love on Top.
So you just sing the chorus two times?
You just sing the chorus, yeah. And it gets you there. Just sing that. So I'd like to see everyone, like, you know, let's gamify, as you would say, Suze. Let's gamify the washing of our hands. Let's enjoy it. It's not panic. It's just prudent. Let's just wash our hands.
Let's just wash our hands.
My God.
I want to add one to that I'm just thinking. I'm like, how fast could we, if we just cleared the afternoon, how quickly could we get a t-shirt up on like Society 6 that it's like in this beautiful, like just hipster graphic just says, wash your hands and don't touch your face. Like, I feel like we could sell out.
That's it. Do you know who is selling merch like that? Oh, what's his name?
Clorox wipes?
No, it's a it's one of the Kardashians' exes.
Kanye, Lamar, I don't know.
No, but it's, what's his name? Anyway, he's selling merchandise already. And he's getting the Kardashian ladies to model it, of course, so that
what?
He can, that says wash your hands and something else. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Spark's already out there.
Look at that.
Yeah. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face.
I think I'll be working on a new song, Ode to Semmelweis, as I wash the cadaverous particles off my hands many, many times
with
per day.
With chlorinated lye.
That's right. Keeping it safe. Keep it clean, my friends.
Is it sung to the tune of Edelweiss?
It could be.
Semmelweis. Every moment I'm washing.
There we go.
It just goes on and on. Writes itself.
It writes itself.
Camion, that is
a
timely spark.
You know what? It's been on my mind, and I was like, let's just dig into this. Tell me more.
We're going to have to rush this episode. We're going to have
to
post this soon.
That's right.
Or not. We're going to be with this for a while.
We shall see.
Hey, let's take a break.
Okay. The Spark
Plug! Camion,
Black
welcome
wow.
back.
Thank
my
you.
Spark is such a different spark than your spark.
Okay. Oh,
my spark title is, and I can sing. My spark sources include the website of the Oakland Unified School District, the website Fords.org, which is the website of the Fords Theater in D.C. You know the one where Lincoln was shot by John Wilkes
Ooh.
Booth. And the HBO documentary, We Are the Dream, the kids of the MLK Oratorical Festival. Camion, have you seen this documentary?
I have not, but I've heard all about it. And Bonnie Siegler told us about it because she worked
that
on
That is exactly
it.
Right. You remember,
yes,
she
yes.
did say that Bonnie Siegler, who we talked to on our recent Makersode, designed the graphics for that film. This is a documentary that HBO produced. It's beautifully directed by a person named Amy Schatz, who I think would be a great person to have a conversation with on a Makersode.
Let's do it.
But let's talk about it.
Okay.
You haven't seen it yet.
I've not seen it, but I have attended festivals that were based off of the
great.
Festival.
Yeah. We're gonna
so
talk,
excited.
We're gonna talk all about it.
I can't wait.
So the documentary We Are the Dream takes place in the city of Oakland. In the film, a principal named Mukta Sambrani from Lincoln Elementary School tells us that Oakland is a very, I have never spent any time there, so I didn't know a lot about it, but apparently it's a very diverse town. It's known for its social justice. It's known for its activism. Mm. It is in close proximity to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
It's associated with the Black Panthers, who started in Oakland, which I did not know until I watched this documentary. But another thing that started in Oakland is the MLK Oratorical Festival, which celebrated its 40th year in 2019. 40th year?
I had no idea.
How about that? From the Oakland Unified School District website, 41 years ago, the founder of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Oratorical Fest, Donald Oliver, had a vision. He wanted to showcase students' oratorical skills, and he wanted to honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Now, I just for a second want to say, that's your person. You got two passionate sparks. You've got somebody who wants to showcase students' oratorical skills. You want to honor Dr. Martin Luther King. You're like, how can I bring these things mm-hmm. together? I love how sparks blend and combine yes. to create actual creative self-expression.
Something even more inspiring that exactly. will create more sparks.
Exactly. Sparks on sparks on sparks. So Donald Oliver felt that testing and reading score data did not truly lift up students' comprehension and fluency skills and abilities. But he knew that delivering an oration was an academic exercise that required students to read, comprehend complex texts in order to analyze, synthesize, interpret, critique, and present or perform that text in a competition in public speaking. So, mm-hmm. so whereas testing and data and all mm-hmm. that stuff, they weren't maybe like, it wasn't going so well, mm-hmm. but he was like, if it really comes alive,
that's right.
That's when things are really going to start to pop.
That's right.
This brings us to the 41st annual OUSD Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Oratorical Festival, in which schools at all grade levels across Oakland have an opportunity to bring Donald Oliver's vision to their students. So that's from their website.
What can I ask you a question?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
they started it. Then schools can say, we want to do that. And they each of the schools do it on their own, or do they come together in a unified
I'm
one?
I'm going to tell Ooh! You, you're going to love it. For 41 years, they've been holding this festival as a school district.
Okay.
And wow. It gives students, listen to this, from pre-K all the way to high school seniors, a chance to speak in front of an audience and to use their voices.
Oh.
I'm going to explain to you how they structure it in just a moment. So the documentary We Are the Dream follows a few students and the adults who are helping them prepare for the festival. And that, so that's their teachers, that's their parents. I have full body chills right now.
Oh God.
The whole festival is produced by a person named Awele Makiba, who is an educator and a beautiful storyteller herself. She says, lifting up student voices is part of fulfilling Dr. King's dream of the power of oration, the power of the word to create social change. That's how we're going to create a better world for all. She also says, it's amazing what's coming out of the hearts and minds of young people today. Mm. They're profound and they're intelligent and they have a vision. And given the opportunity to share and to listen, there's so much to learn.
Oh, that's so
Awele true. Awele Makiba is this is a person who I just feel like, yes, she's a person. She looks like a person. She dresses like a person. But I think inside, she's fully automated by sparks. It just seems like she is a remarkable teacher.
My gosh.
She's a remarkable, she acts as sort of the MC and the host for the big festival.
Yeah.
And I couldn't take my eyes off of her.
Oh, how
she's
incredible.
Really, really, I think she's super special.
Oh,
yeah. She's
I
really
can't
something.
Can't wait to watch this.
Yeah. Yeah. So from her, we learned that 800 to 1,200 students participate in the festival using poetry, both original poetry and published poetry, speeches, famous and not so famous, and monologues, right? So you sort mm-hmm. of, you can choose, there's a variety of things that you mm-hmm. can choose from.
Mm-hmm.
Another teacher named Ann Park from Bridges Academy said that their students participate every year, and it gives them a chance to not only understand the power of MLK's words, but it also gives them a chance to understand the power of their words,
Ooh.
How they can make a difference also,
mm-hmm.
Which I really loved, because sometimes it's that beautiful, like crafted, established, published,
right.
you know, tried and tested language.
Right.
And sometimes it's stuff that they've conceived of and that they've developed,
Ooh.
Which I think I love that they're having that experience.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So to answer your question, Cams, it begins with festivals at each individual school.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you perform at your school and you win, then you go to the semifinals,
uh-huh.
wherein 48 schools send their top placing students to compete, totaling about 163 presentations.
Wow.
That's the semifinals. Then 64 of those presentations are awarded a blue ribbon, and they go on to compete in the big time, baby, the show, the district finals.
Big show!
The big show!
Oh my God.
Those students, about 64 presentations, they are getting in front of hundreds of people. And it provides an opportunity for students whose talents may not be highlighted in the classroom, mm-hmm. right?
That's right.
One of the adults in the documentary points out, these could be future politicians or yep. writers. That's the purpose of education, helping kids to discover their own passions.
Oh my gosh.
But they're making space with this festival. They're making space for it sometimes outside of classroom hours. So mm-hmm. it could be something that they do after school. It could be something that happens on the weekends, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. And if you're the type of student, like you were, Camian, or maybe like I was, or other people who are listening to this, who this might be an unawakened passion or skill set that you have.
That's right.
This is providing an opportunity to access that and give you a chance to shine.
Yes. That's exciting.
Cams, the students in this documentary, let's learn a little bit about them.
Okay.
At the Piedmont Avenue School, there's a third grader named Gregory. And Gregory performs a tribute to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., compiled by an educator named Zarita Sharp. Zarita Sharp coaches Gregory mm-hmm. through the speech. She gets him to relax. She's teaching him how to just breathe, to use his powerful oratorical voice, and also to let him know that those nervous butterflies, when they come, they will come. But when they come, to keep speaking, to yes. continue speaking. And it's so yes. interesting because you're seeing these young people whose brains are not fully formed, and you see their brains growing in real time. You see
it's
them
incredible.
Over the course of the documentary getting better. You see them improving, which...
It's so incredible because you're learning to deal with, on the one hand, the feelings that come up when you're in front of people saying anything. That's mm-hmm. a set of feelings that yep. can be pretty intense.
Yeah.
And that must be understood and conquered in some way. And then you have the set of feelings that you are intending to evoke.
That's right.
That in are moving, the piece that are moving through
in addition
you.
To your adrenaline, maybe some cortisol.
That's right.
That you also have the feelings of Dr. Martin Luther King's words moving through you, which
That's
is
right,
another set of feelings.
Which gives me chills just thinking
yes,
about.
Yeah.
And you're learning to navigate all of that and deliver.
Yeah. And
wow.
To get ahead of myself a little bit, you and I both go into different situations, corporate situations, things like that. And we help people get better at public speaking and presenting. And if you want to get better at public speaking and presenting, as an adult, watch We Are the Dream, because a lot of the advice that they're giving to these students holds true and holds up well into adulthood.
So good.
It's
We've talked about this a lot. I firmly believe that every single person, no matter what your job is, would benefit from learning how to speak in front of a group of people.
Agreed. 100%.
Whether that's the 5 people that you manage yep. or it's 100 people in the district office.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree.
Wow.
Back to the spark. There is a boy named Karunyan. His mother and father are immigrants from Sri Lanka. His mother's father was arrested and disappeared 20 years earlier in Sri Lanka. And Karunyan gives this impassioned speech about it, talks about his grandfather, talks about what if we had somebody like Martin Luther King to, you know, lead the way for us now. Seeing his mom coach him, seeing his mother and father's love and pride for their son, and she has great advice for her son. Whenever he talks, let it come from his heart. Which is great advice. And I know that can sound very simple, but that's great advice
that's
for a speaker.
Advice.
It's great advice. From Allendale Elementary, there's a student named Lovely. Lovely has been doing oratorical since the second grade. And in the 2019 competition, which is documented in the documentary, she performs a poem that she wrote herself called What You Know About. in the documentary, her father helps her prepare for the competition. And he talks about how he has Lovely get up and recite her poem wherever there's an opportunity. So if he's shopping for clothes at his clothing store or at the barber shop, she's getting in front of people all the time, which is fantastic advice for any speaker, any orator, a stand-up comic, an improviser. Get up as often as you can.
Yes.
Lovely has some great advice for speakers too. Know the words by heart, say it clearly and loudly so everyone can hear, and don't say it too fast.
Oh,
I was like, yeah, Lovely. That's exactly perfect. That's how you do it. There's a young man named Donovan who shares a piece that was sparked by a news story of two African-American men who were arrested while waiting for a business colleague in a Starbucks. Many of us know this story. In his piece, he says these words, which he wrote, "Social media, if used the correct way, can be a positive and powerful vehicle for social change and justice. What if we cared more about gun laws than we did about how many followers we have? What if we talked to each other instead of commenting rude things about each other? Mm. What if we built each other up instead of tearing each other down?" It's so, I don't know, heartening to me, inspiring to me to see these young people, yes, doing the established writing, but also sharing things that they've written themselves, sparked by things they've seen on the news that they can't wrap their minds around. Mm-hmm. And so they have conversations with their parents and their teachers and try to understand it and then try to present it, get their arms around it in a way that helps them understand it, but also to use their words to try to impact change. I feel it's everything. It's all I want to do in life.
Exactly.
It's all I want to do.
Huge. Yeah. And you, like you said, you are learning to communicate in a different way, in a way that is inspiring understanding and inspiring action.
Yes.
And change.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, what they're referring to in the social media where like anyone can tear each other down.
Yeah.
But can you use your voice to make a difference for good?
I wonder, as I was watching it, I was like, as Donovan says these words, is it impacting? Like, can the students who are all sitting gathered listening, and even like their big brothers and sisters, their parents, the teachers, like, can they take it in? Maybe it is making change. That is my hope. My favorite student is an 8-year-old girl named Madeline Gabara, who performs a poem in the solo competition. There's solo competition and there's also group competition.
Wow.
She performs a poem called In Mis Sueños by Francisco Alarcón. She performs it in Spanish and in English. She is about as big as a minute. She is just, but Camion, she is so good. She is so grounded. She has some good advice for speakers. She talks about in the documentary, she said she was nervous before she did her poem, but then she took a deep breath and she relaxed. And I was like, yeah, Madeline. Yeah. That's it.
That's
you should see her tell her poem. It is, she's so good. And picture, if you will, Camion, a gigantic, like the biggest high school auditorium you have ever seen in your life.
Okay.
The biggest, a big, dark, empty stage and a little teeny tiny 3-foot-tall person in the middle of that stage, just owning it. Just owning it.
God, that's awesome.
So good. There's so much wisdom in this documentary. They have this fantastic footage of MLK speaking to young students and saying, however young you are, you have a responsibility to seek to make your nation a better nation in which to live. And as we were saying, you can see these students are just beginning to do that. Sometimes it can be rote. Sometimes it can seem like my teacher told me to do it this way. Do you know what I mean? But sometimes you see something else that's beginning to awaken in them and you see them making it their own. In this documentary, there's an 11-year-old student named Victoria who says, Dr. Martin Luther King, he made a legacy. I may not be known. I may just be another kid in the world, but at the same time, I feel like I am somebody. So because of that, I feel like I have to give my best. I feel like I'm doing this for him.
Oh.
These students are inspired by Dr. King. I'm inspired by these students. It's just like a cycle of inspiration, y'all. The educator Winston Williams from Markham Elementary School is shown preparing his young students for a group performance. He talks about how the oratorical festival is an educational tool for him. It's an educational tool that he uses. He selects pieces that are going to teach something about African American history,
mm-hmm.
and talks about how in the 60s, they fought to get more Black history in the schools. And over the years since then, all the African American history has slowly been picked away so that there's nothing left except Dr. Martin Luther King. So the oratorical festival gives the students a chance to ask questions about history, questions that don't come up in their curriculum.
That's right.
So his students are doing a piece about Black Panthers. So they're getting to learn about the Black Panthers,
yes.
which is from their town.
That's right.
And Mr. Williams also has great advice for public speaking. The posture is just as important as the words, which Cammie and you talk about all the time.
So true.
Like, what story is your body telling?
Before you even open your mouth.
Before you even open your mouth.
Wow.
So, yeah, I'm telling you, it's got it all, this documentary.
I can't wait.
It comes from, and it comes from all sources. It comes from the parents. It comes from the teachers. It comes from the students. The finals end with the award ceremony where you see how all the different orators fared. And after that, it looks like there's this big old dance party in the auditorium right there, like amongst the seats, like there's a big conga line and that snakes past the judges table.
Oh.
And it looks like a total celebration and a real party.
And it's people from all over the community. Then it's different schools and districts and parents and kids and everyone. Oh my God.
Yeah.
What a unifying
experience. It's a really cool thing that the city of Oakland created and has continued to celebrate. So last week I spoke with an artist and an educator named Kate Crawford, who we'll meet on a Makersode. She has done this work with, she's done mask work. She's done oratory and a whole host of other creativities in her classroom, but she likened oratory to mask work. She said that there's something about the experience of putting on a mask. There's this incredible freedom and willingness to experiment because there's a safety, not anonymity or hiding, but a melding with the quality of the mask that she has observed frees people. She says that oratory also has this certain deep safety that can come from inhabiting the words of someone else, like a piece of extraordinary writing that has been made to be said out loud, something that the author has honed via like 17 different drafts. And by the time that piece of writing gets to the students, it is finely burnished. It carries the resonance of all the people who have heard it. It has weight, it has cultural resonance, and it carries an energy. So when a student memorizes it, gets it into their brain and their body and their heart, there's something deep and important about that. She said, oral narrative is baked into our evolution, and oratory is a space where the art form of oral narrative can live on through these young people. And I was like, I thought that was, I love Kate Crawford. I'm so happy that you introduced her to me and soon all our listeners.
I love her.
But
too.
I loved She's the way amazing. She talked about it because I was like, yeah, that's it.
Yes.
I thought there was really something to what she was saying.
Absolutely.
An Irish political leader named James Connolly is quoted by one of the oratorical festival judges in the documentary. The quote is, "No revolutionary movement is complete without its poetical expression." No revolutionary movement is complete without its poets and its poetical expression. The judge goes on to say, a large part of social movement is art and imagining new just possibilities. The power of the word is all you need is a pen and a piece of paper to share it. And that's where all the magic happens. And I was like, Yeah, there is. I feel like it's in our conversation, maybe I might be misremembering, with Donna Lieberman, where she talks about every revolution having those artists.
That's right.
That are Bonnie Siegler, too.
I was going to say, Bonnie talks about it as well. And yeah, with Bonnie, it's like the power of images to convey and elicit an emotional response.
To help you to understand something in a way that you can
and take action, to feel compelled to act.
Yes.
But then this is like the companion piece to it. It is the words, the spoken words, and the power of oratory to elicit a response and incite people to act.
It really can be magical that... Kate talked about this when she has been present for festivals that have been modeled after this type of oratorical festival.
That's right.
That the emotional charge in the room is as powerful as any gathering of people she's ever been present for. A judge in the documentary is a spoken word artist named Sivan Kalee Bolt, a Bay Area poet. And Sivan Kalee says something in the documentary that felt so true to me. Walking into this oratorical festival made me way more hopeful about change coming.
Oh.
And I felt that way when I watched it. Mm-hmm. It made me way more hopeful about change coming.
I feel that way, Suze. Like, I haven't seen this documentary and I can't wait to, but I have seen these festivals in action, a much smaller scale. Like it's not competitive and it doesn't like ladder up to those finals.
Yeah.
But it's truly, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Like I pretty much weep through the whole thing.
Yes. So I actually spoke with a fifth grader named Siri, who participated in her school's oratorical festival here in New York. Siri had done a group presentation when she was in the fourth grade, and she decided to do a personal presentation when she got to fifth grade. She chose the poem herself. She was looking through a poetry book, and this poem really resonated for her. It was talking about how we're all connected in a way, and that you have to have hope, even when it's hard to have hope. She felt like it would resonate for all kinds of people and translate to everyone who heard it, no matter what they were going through. So she said she prepared it for about a month and a half. She worked on, this is good advice, she worked on it a little bit every day in order to memorize it. It's good creative advice, everybody. And to figure out how to best present it. One of her teachers helped Siri with her preparations. And she said performing her piece at the oratorical festival felt kind of magical in a way. Even though she was in front of an audience, it felt like she was alone. Her poem didn't require that she look at people. She sort of had her eyes lifted up. And Siri described it like floating and talking in her own existence, were her words. I asked Siri how she felt after she finished sharing her piece, and she said it was hard to describe all the emotions she felt inside. Physically and mentally, she felt amazing and terrible at the same time. Amazing because she had done it and survived through it, but terrible because her legs were shaking and she cried for a long time afterwards. Mm. Like after being in such control of her body to deliver her piece, afterwards, she didn't have to be in control. Mm. So a lot of feelings came up. And I told her that made sense to me because when something moves, it's what you were just saying, Camion, when something moves through you like that powerful self-expression, and then maybe the audience goes bananas, and you have like some adrenaline and maybe a little cortisol. So you can feel shaky legs, you can feel weepy eyes, you can feel lots and lots and lots of feelings. But the more that you experience that, the easier it gets to let those feelings pass up and through you. And I described it sort of like a good thunderstorm that kind of rolls in, and there's lightning and there's thunder and there's a lot of stuff going on. And then it sort of concludes, the rain tapers off and it rolls out again. And you can sort of become stronger and more accustomed to that sort of cycle in your self-expression.
Mm-hmm.
Even with all the feelings that Siri felt, she said that she would definitely do it again. She said she really liked the feeling because it felt like she had done a really big thing. I asked Siri if she had any advice for a student who might want to participate in an oratorical festival, and she said, it is a little scary in the beginning, and it can feel kind of tricky. And if you're doing an established piece, you have to remember that these are someone else's words, and your job is to honor those words. And it's your job to honor the author as a great person and a leader. In her experience, Siri says she didn't need to pay attention to herself so much because she was focused on honoring the words and the person who wrote them. This is fantastic advice. If you have to speak publicly, if you're an actor, sometimes I've really struggled with stage fright. And one of the keys to getting past that was making it not about myself. It's not about me. It's about my scene partner. It's about the audience. It's about honoring the words of the text that I'm sharing. So I was like, oh, out of the mouth of Siri. So smart. Siri said she's planning to do another piece in this year's Oratorical Festival. She's getting ready to pick her poem. The piece Siri did at last year's Oratorical Festival is entitled A Gift to Sing by James Weldon Johnson. James Weldon Johnson was born in Jacksonville, Florida in 1871, and he was not only a poet, but also a major leader in the NAACP and the first African-American professor to teach at New York University.
Mm.
There's a spark for you. This is Siri's poem that she recited, The Gift to Sing by James Weldon Johnson. Sometimes the mist overhangs my path and blackening clouds about me cling. But oh, I have a magic way to turn the gloom to cheerful day. I softly sing. And if the way grows darker still, shadowed by sorrow's somber wing, with glad defiance in my throat, I pierce the darkness with a note and sing and sing. I brood not over the broken past, nor dread whatever time may bring. No nights are dark, no days are long, while in my heart there swells a song, and I can sing. That one goes out to you, Siri.
Siri,
I have to say,
so good.
I think you were in the room to see Siri tell that poem.
I was in the room. We may even have a video. I was just over here thinking, can we share this video?
We'll check. We have to check with Siri.
We have to check, but it brought me to tears.
Yeah.
Honestly, it was stunning. And she held everyone breathless.
Yes. I've watched the video about 7 times.
Oh.
She's really wonderful.
She's really, really
She nailed wonderful. It. She really, yeah. really nailed it.
And she had complete, like you were describing her, talking about having had control over her body. She had such control over her body, her breath, her voice. It was masterful.
I also thought the way that she delivered it, and this may have come from her, this may have come from the preparation that she did with her teacher, but it was so sophisticated. Like it was really, really sophisticated. There was an understatement to it. I was beyond there for it.
Yeah.
I just thought it was so great.
Incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty wonderful. What do we make of it? What has been made of it? Well, an amazing oratorical festival that is a real point of pride for the city of Oakland. And other, as you were saying, Cam's, other oratorical festivals, some of which have been modeled after the MLK Oratorical Festival in Oakland. On the website, fords.org, they have a great guide for how to host your own oratorical festival.
Wow.
There are organizational guides, there's study guides, handouts, curriculum. If any of this is sparking you, whether you're a teacher or whether you're a parent or whether you're a student, like if any of this is sparking you, check it out at fords.org. I'm telling you, We Are the Dream is also sparking me to move to Oakland. That community seems amazing. Don't know if I can afford it, but wow, it seemed really, really cool. Also, side spark, throughout the documentary, they feature all of these gorgeous murals that are all over Oakland. And that was sparking me in a whole different direction.
Yes, yes.
So I'm sparked by Siri.
The teachers, it sounds like. Oh, all the teachers. And the parents.
It's It's a good time.
Yeah.
It's a really, really good time.
I can't wait to watch this.
Also, I noticed on the website for Oakland's MLK Oratorical Festival that they state that they may or may not have the budget due to cuts to give out these small trophies, and that it might just be certificates and ribbons. And if you're a parent who wants to purchase a trophy for your student, they link to vendors. These aren't big trophies. These are just little teen trophies.
Yeah.
And I thought, there's a spark. Make a donation so that they can have trophies.
Oh my God. Yeah.
At the MLK Oratorical Festival. Because work your mind back to when you were young.
Yeah. And how much that
it matters. It matters. So there's a spark, maybe.
That's something we all could do.
Yeah.
Chip right into
that. P.S. They don't ask for donations, and I don't even know if they're set up to receive donations, but they do have an address, and you do have a checkbook, I bet.
Aww.
Grab your mom's checkbook. JK, JK, JK. So that's my spark, Cams.
Oh, that's a good one. That's an emotional one, I have to say. It brought back a lot of memories of seeing, of like being present for the festival and for Siri. Really good stuff.
I should acknowledge, though, that this spark, I feel like, came from you. I learned it from you, Dad. This spark came from you. You were the first person I'd ever heard about this from. And then I heard it again from Bonnie Siegler because she had done the graphics for the documentary.
We Are the Dream,
And so thank you for sliding a spark my way.
Spark. That's what we're doing here. That's what
you're always
what it's
so
all
you're
about.
So great. You're always like, there are sparks. There are more sparks
so
than there are
for all of us.
Then there is time to process them. So thank you for the spark, Kimian.
You are welcome. And now it belongs to all of us, and people can run with it. If you got inspired, please take it and make something.
Take
of it
and make it. I guess that's it. We hope this put another bunch of sparks in your spark file. Listen, if there's a spark, I wonder how many times in the average episode of this show we say the word spark. If there is a spark you'd like us to explore, or if you've taken a sparkly spark and fanned it into a creative flame and you'd like to share that, email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com or submit it through our website, thesparkfile.com.
We will even happily take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you have to share a creative risk that you have taken recently.
It's too true, Kamian. You can also follow us on social media and be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, rate, 5-star review it. If you like this podcast, share it with people you love. If you didn't like it, there's only about 90 more seconds to go, so hang tight.
You're going
to
make it. If something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, we're writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that has been knocking at your door. It is your turn to take a spark, and fan it into a flame.
You got to speak it. You got to dancing cheek to cheek it. You got to do like Rick James did and mother up and freak it. You got to take it. And make it.
Bye.
Spark,
when I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark file. Could be something that I wanna make or how I wanna be. I pump it in my spark file. I jump into my spark file. Let's open up the spark.